Case number 12-5379, Eric O. Autor, for appellants, Penny Sue Pritzker in her official capacity as Secretary of Commerce et al. Mr. Rothfeld for appellants, Mr. Roth for appellees.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Charles Rothfeld, Mayor Brown, representing the plaintiffs' appellants in this case. The question presented here is whether the plaintiffs may be denied the opportunity to serve on government advisory committees because they are registered lobbyists. And the answer to that question is provided by a simple and fundamental rule. Government cannot deny individuals benefits or opportunities because they exercise constitutional rights, and that is what is going on here. That is the unconstitutional conditions doctrine, which has been applied repeatedly and consistently by this Court and by the Supreme Court. And as articulated by the Supreme Court, that doctrine holds that although an individual may have no right to a particular benefit, a particular opportunity, and although the government may deny that benefit for any number of legitimate reasons, it may not deny that benefit because the person exercised a constitutional right.
Why isn't this a Pickering case?
I think two things to say about that. First, if to be a Pickering case, that presupposes that there is a constitutional interest that's at stake and that is affected by the government.
Okay, well, let's assume you're right. But why isn't the proper analytical structure Pickering rather than the other constitutional benefits case?
The benefits cases trigger the Pickering inquiry because the benefits cases show that there is a constitutional interest at stake.
It's a dramatically different standard of burden on the government. I assume if it's a Perry v. Sinderman case, if you're right about that, then wouldn't strict scrutiny apply? Whereas if Pickering is the proper structure, it's your balancing test.
Well, I think that we are, in terms of the balancing test that the government has argued applies in this case, the Court has said very clearly in cases like the NTU case, this Court and the Supreme Court both said, that when there is a blanket restriction on the assertion of government rights imposed by the government in a Pickering context, the burden on the government is a very substantial one. It has to demonstrate.
But can we go back to the antecedent question? Tell me why it's not a Pickering case. Why shouldn't we view members of the advisory committees as essentially unpaid employees? Because they're right. That's their role. They're advising the government.
I think that's right, Ron. I don't mean to resist the statement that the Court can engage in a Pickering-type analysis. Our position is that we prevail on that very clearly.
Well, but that's not an issue before us today, right? I mean, if you're right, under either theory, this has to go back to the district court to do the proper balancing, doesn't it?
That's probably right. Our view, frankly, is that it is clear on the face of it that as a matter of law that this is an insupportable restriction. If the Court disagrees with that, then yes, it would have to go back to the district court to perform the balancing inquiry, because the district court thought there was no First Amendment interest at stake here at all and dismissed the case for that reason.
Right.
And if the Court disagrees, at a minimum, it would have to go back. Again, we think that on the face of it, the government has not really articulated any rationale that I can understand under Pickering as to why this restriction is supportable. If you look at the particular characteristics of the ITACs, the International Trade Advisory Committees, which are at stake here, they are designed expressly and exclusively to provide an opportunity for the private sector to have its views presented to and considered by government officials. And the government's only rationale for why lobbyists are excluded is because they have experience and regularly present the views of private interests to the government. It seems to me that, in fact, the operation and the efficacy of the ITACs are undermined by excluding lobbyists. These are people whose job it is to provide private sector views to the government. They have experience doing that, and they've been selected by the private sector interests.
But we have nothing in the record about this at all. Isn't that right? I mean, how I'm not sure quite how we would do the balancing at this point.
Well,
other than guessing.
Again, I'll give you two.
The government's really never had an opportunity to explain on the record why it feels that lobbyists should be excluded from these particular advisory committees.
Well, I'll give you two answers to that, Your Honor. I guess one is yes, if the Court thinks that it needs a record to resolve that question, a factual record, then it would have to be remanded. But our position, again, is that it's as a matter of law, it's plain on the face of it. The rationale for the creation of the ITAX, and the statutory function, the regulatory function of the ITAX is very clear on the face of the statute and the regulations. It is to provide exclusively private sector interests to government officials. And the only rationale the government has articulated for keeping lobbyists off of ITAX is that they have experience and regularly provide the views of private sector to government officials. Mm-hmm. On the face of it, that would seem an insupportable rationale. And so I would submit as a matter of law that cannot be a justification for this restriction on First Amendment rights. If the court disagrees with and thinks that there has to be more of a factual determination made along those lines, then yes, the case would go back to the district
court. What is the benefit here? Is there anything more than prestige involved?
Well, I think there are a couple of things to say about that. First, I think there are a range of benefits that are provided, and certainly there is an opportunity that's provided to obtain experience, expertise, to get insights into the operation of the U.S. formulation of U.S. trade policy. Certainly that individuals are eligible to serve on ITAX is very valuable to their employers, their private sector employers, and therefore necessarily is valuable to them as well. And, of course, they get the satisfaction of service of having done something like this. This is at least as tangible and valuable to an individual as, for example, the right to serve as a government volunteer, which was held by the Ninth Circuit in the Highland case to trigger application of the unconstitutional conditions doctrine, or the opportunity to serve on an Adopt-a-Highway program held by the Eighth Circuit in the Cuffley case to be sufficient to trigger. And I think that necessarily is so, because if you look at the rationale for the doctrine, as articulated by this Court and the Supreme Court, it's that the government should not have the ability to accomplish indirectly what it may not do directly. And that plainly is what this lobbying ban does, because if you look at the reality of it, thousands of people have deregistered as lobbyists in order to preserve their opportunity to serve on advisory committees. I think that tells us that it is a very valuable thing to them, that it's a opportunity that people want to have, and that their behavior is being modified in reaction to this restriction on the rights which is imposed by the government.
But you're not saying that this is similar to retaliation cases, right, where there's, you know, obviously some protected speech or something like that, and the government retaliates and therefore terminates a volunteer position or something like that. This seems different.
Well, this is a blanket restriction. I mean, it's true it's not an individual retaliatory action, but it's to give you a parallel, the NTEU case in which there was a blanket restriction on government employees accepting honoraria. And both this court and the Supreme Court said, you are restricting speech not on the basis of its content, but you're restricting the ability to engage in speech. That is a constitutionally protected interest, and we have to engage, and in a Pickering context, we have to engage in a very close review of this, because you are imposing blanket restrictions on rights. These are not individually tailored determinations made retrospectively. This is a prospective determination that individuals simply cannot engage in this opportunity otherwise, which I think the government concedes they otherwise would be entitled to do. And if I may, Your Honor, I'll turn
down some time. This case?
Excuse me?
Isn't the employment case very different from this case?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because if you look at the structure of the ITACs, I mean, they are, I think, in the relevant respects, quite similar to government employment. There is a regularized government program in which these people, with established selection criteria in which these people would be eligible to participate, just as in the government context, no one has the right to a government job, but the job cannot be burdened by unconstitutional conditions opposed to it. Exactly the same thing is true here. These people would at least have an opportunity fairly to participate in the ITAC process, and they are barred from doing that because they've exercised their First Amendment right to petition.
Would we seriously doubt that government employees or employees could be barred from lobbying?
Well, I give two answers to that, Your Honor. I think the Pickering test would apply there, and it may well be for current government employees that barring them from lobbying would advance the efficacy of the federal service. Because of the unique character of the ITACs, they are designed to have people present private sector views to the government, excluding people who have experience doing that simply because they do have experience doing that. It seems a very difficult showing for the government to make as to why that increases the efficacy or advances the purposes of the ITAC regime. If I may resume the balance.
This policy that you're challenging, that applies to all advisory committees, right?
It does, that's right.
Not just ITACs. Do you have a sense of what the implications of this would be for other advisory committees? Have you looked at the other type of advisory committees to see whether... I know your view is that the government can't justify the exclusion here, but what about other advisory committees?
Well, I think it was probably not a one-size-fits-all rule that would come out of this. I think the ITACs are unique for the reasons that we've explained. To the extent that their advisory committees have other purposes, it may well be that the government could justify restrictions on lobbying. I'm not saying that they could, but it would be a different inquiry. It's not one that has been engaged in yet by anybody in this case.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John.
May it please the court. The Supreme Court has made clear that the government has broad authority to choose its advisors. The ITACs here were established.
You're talking about Knight.
Exactly.
But that's not their case. They're not arguing, as in Knight, that they have a right to have the government.
No, Your Honor.
Listen to them. They're arguing that the government is discriminating against them because of their exercise of a constitutional right. It's a different theory.
No, not that theory, you're right. They're not arguing that they have a right to be on the committee, but Knight also, on page 289 to 90 of the opinion, addressed and rejected a claim that the Minnesota statute at issue there impermissibly burdened their associational rights. And that really is analogous to
this
circumstance.
Well, that's because in Knight, the burden on associational rights was caused by the union, not the state.
That's not true, Your Honor. That aspect concerned slightly before that part of the opinion a claim that the union were engaging in retaliating against their speech. There was a separate issue addressed on page 289 to 90 of the opinion dealing with an associational interest, and the claim was that the statute burdened their associational interest by making it, as the court said, pressured them. The court recognized the statute pressured them to join the union in order for them to be eligible to serve on and to have a chance at serving on the meet and confer committees at issue there. And they said that was not unconstitutional.
Collective bargaining cases are situations in which the court is essentially saying this is a legitimate government interest to order collective bargaining in this arranged way, and so some are advantaged, some are disadvantaged. I don't see how that's the same.
It really is, Your Honor, for purposes of the constitutional analysis. Here we're talking about whether there's any...
If in the collective bargaining cases, the state law set up the scheme and they said, and incidentally, no Latinos can serve on union committees.
Right. Well, here what we're talking about is the president's ability to determine who it wants to hear from.
Well, and the government here, in the hypothetical, says no Latinos. We don't want to hear from them.
Right. And we're not...
You don't doubt that it's an unconstitutional condition, right?
Well, again...
You don't doubt that, right?
Do you think the government
doesn't have a case?
We think that that's a much different circumstance where you've got...
a close case?
No, we're saying that in the context of advisory committees that have statutory restrictions, like a fair balance requirement and requirements that Congress has chosen to impose upon them, that's one thing. But the question is whether the Constitution forecloses the president from saying, I don't want to hear from particular voices in this setting.
The president could say, I don't want to hear from Latinos.
The president has broad latitude to determine who he wants to hear from. We're not saying
my
that.
My hypothetical could say that.
Well, don't forget, the president, when he decides who to hear from, has to answer to the public
Why don't you answer Judge Edwards' question?
Come on, this is not a surprise.
We're not arguing.
I didn't know this question was coming, because I can give you a whole list of possibilities. I'm just using Latinos now.
Right, and we're not...
Substitute anything you want. You really think the president could impose that kind of condition?
Not necessarily in the context of an informal advisory committee, but what we're saying here is that that in connection with what the Constitution does by way of precluding the president from choosing its advisors, there really are very, very few restrictions. The president can decide that in this context he doesn't wish to hear from paid registered lobbyists, and there's nothing in the First Amendment that restricts him in this manner. Now, as I said, these particular committees, they were adopted, then they're subject to the Advisory Committee Act. and the Congress has imposed certain statutory restrictions on the way that...
So the president could have a formal arrangement of this sort and say, but anyone who votes cannot participate.
We think that's right. You're right. There is no restriction. The First Amendment does not foreclose the president from determining who he wishes to hear from.
It's different to argue that in his role in thinking about legislation, et cetera, the president can confer with whom he wants, whom he or she wants. It's quite a different thing to say that in setting up a formal scheme within the government realm, that the president can impose the list of conditions that I'm beginning to raise, and you're saying quite definitely,
again,
can block all kinds of people, whether they want to vote, whether Latino, African-American, whatever. I can publicly announce that as a condition of participating in this government arrangement, they are barred because I don't want to hear from them.
Your
That's
Honor,
absurd.
We're not talking about some unalterable characteristic that has nothing, any whatsoever relation to the committee at issue. Here what we're talking about is the voices that he wishes to hear from, and the president has extremely broad latitude in that regard. And the political affiliation cases are highly instructive in that regard. They've made clear that policy-making advisors can be fired on the basis of their policy-related speech. And here we don't have actions taken in retaliation for any speech. This is far removed from any kind of Pickering case at all. But even in the Pickering context...
Is that because you think lobbying is not a First Amendment protected right?
No, it's because, as Judge Brown was indicating, this is not a case in which we're burdening unconstitutionally any activity. They're free to lobby as much as they want, and this kind of this benefit.
So you agree with the district court then that are you now moving away from Knight and saying that even if Perry is the standard, it doesn't apply because there's no governmental benefit?
Well, we're saying both, Your Honor. Yeah,
I was asking you an alternative question.
Yeah,
okay. I understand your argument about Knight.
Right.
My question is, if we don't agree with you about Knight, what is your argument? What is your argument then? Is it that there's no governmental benefit?
That this is not the type of benefit that's ever been found to be applicable.
Well, do you have any cases that say it's not?
We don't have any case in which there's been any. But we don't. The important thing is there's never been an application of the unconstitutional condition doctrine in a manner that restricts the government from choosing its
advisors.
Well,
now you're going back to Knight. My question was, assuming we don't agree with you about Knight, is your argument then that there is no governmental benefit, or is it that, as Judge Edwards asked you, that lobbyists are not engaged in First Amendment activity?
Well, it's not.
Which is the district court thought it was both.
We think both that it is not.
In your brief, you don't argue. I didn't see you defending the district court's position that this was not First Amendment protected.
No, we're not saying that lobbying isn't protected by the First Amendment. We are saying that this isn't an impermissible burden on that activity.
And why is that? Is that because the district court said because it wasn't quantifiable? Is that your position?
Because there's no restriction on them lobbying to their heart's content on their own behalf, and the only restriction is that if they exceed the 20% threshold and become a lobbyist for purposes of the statute. But the important thing is that this. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Yeah. Well, I'd like you to answer my question about, and the same question Judge Brown asked the plaintiff's lawyer, which is to focus on exactly why it's not a governmental benefit. Remember, this is a motion to dismiss. So we have an allegation that it's a benefit, correct? That there's benefits that flow from this. That's all we have in the record.
Well,
and counsel said, look, there's lots of advantages to this. It's an opportunity to appear before the government agency. It's good for your resume. There's lots of benefits they say might flow from it. So what's the reason for rejecting that? The district court said it wasn't quantifiable. Is that the reason?
It's not that. It's the sole purpose of this is to advise the government. Mm-hmm. It is not to provide any benefits. And they cite the cases that they cite to. The Adopt a Highway program wasn't designed to benefit, to provide advice to the government. The Highland case was also, the court found that these volunteers should be partially, could under state law potentially be treated as employees, and in any event, they were provided, in part it was intended to provide them with valuable experience. This isn't intended to do that. This is, these individuals serve in a representational capacity. It's not designed to give them valuable benefits. Any potential ephemeral or ethereal benefits that they do get, which are hard to quantify, are ancillary and totally incidental to the fact that this is a purely advisory body to serve, to provide the executive branch with important policy advice regarding trade policy. And that's why we don't think the unconstitutional condition doctrine has never been applied in circumstances like this, and with good reason, because it would impede the ability of government to choose their advisors.
Well, no, not if it's a Pickering balancing test. The government, under the Pickering standard, the government, you would balance the interests of the plaintiffs against the government's reason for wanting to exclude lobbyists, wouldn't you?
Well, even in the Pickering, even if in cases where Pickering properly applies, where you're dealing with policymakers, and policymakers as the First Circuit in the Foote v. Town of Bedford case, which is cited on page 25 of the other side's opening brief, makes clear that's advisors can be policymakers, and this court in Hall v. Ford has recognized that in those contexts, that policymakers, like these advisors in these circumstances, for purposes of Pickering SP, they can be fired for their policy-related speech.
Suppose
so you can take into account political affiliation speech in that context.
Suppose the record showed that lobbyists who serve on these committees do realize enormous, including enormous financial benefits from their role in the committees, that they get hired more by other people, that they get asked to speak, that their careers are better because of this service. Still not enough?
Still not enough
in
these
circumstances.
Because the sole function of this is to provide advice for us. That's why we're setting this up. We're not setting it up as a boon to lobbyists to further bolster their ability to enhance their careers. And they're
what
serving in this.
Has, what you intend has nothing to do with whether they're getting a benefit.
Right.
It doesn't follow. You keep saying, well, we don't mean for them to get a benefit. That doesn't belie the fact that they may be getting substantial benefits. So what?
Well, again,
I'm not getting it. I understand your vigorous in your belief, but there are some questions we're trying to get answered, and you simply stick with the vigor of your belief instead of answering our question. Let me take you back to the right to vote. Do you think that's a straightforward case that the president, in this formal setting, I'm not talking about the president having advisors of any sort that he or she wants, that we understand in history happens all the time, for reasons that better that we don't know. This is a formal structure. The president announces, here's what we're going to do. And we're going to have these very important advisory committees, and they will be very involved, have confidential data. They have to sign off on the final thing that affects our international relations. But anyone who votes is not allowed.
Well, again, we don't think that the Constitution would constrain
just
that.
Just tell me, what is your, I need to understand your bottom line. Are you saying it's because there's no benefit? Are you saying because there's no constitutional right? Or what are you saying?
We're saying that it's just that we don't think it makes sense to employ this unconstitutional conditions doctrine in the context of where it's butting up against the government's freedom to choose its advisors. Now, there are statutory constraints that Congress has chosen to put in.
The difference between statutory constraints and the presidential limitations, if each of them purport to be lawful limitations, what difference does it make whether Congress imposed it or the president imposed the rule? This is a public offering. This is a, here's, I'm offering this to the public, but there are conditions.
No, but the question is, what does the Constitution do by way of limiting the president's ability to decide who he wants to hear from? And prior to FACA, no one thought.
So you're saying that my list is fanciful. The president could put any one of those many things that you know I have in my mind and say, if you're in this category, if you speak, if you vote, whatever, any of these things, I tell you what I want, and I don't care whether my conditions are arbitrary, unconstitutional, otherwise unconstitutional. If Congress did them, I can do it in this public forum. That's it. That's your case.
Well, we think the very broad. We're not talking about a case here in which there's some unalterable characteristic that's wholly unrelated to the activity.
That's why I'm going to take the right to vote.
But where you're talking about the government's ability, the president in particular, to say, whose voices do I want to hear from in this particular context?
Saying, save for the unalterable condition, the president can impose any other kind of restriction, even though you would agree readily Congress couldn't. The president cannot in this situation, because it's the president, even though it's a formal arrangement, the president can do it.
I think that I don't know. I'm not aware.
Well, I just understand your position. It's a strange position, but I understand.
The president really should have broad authority to decide who to hear from.
Whether you think the president should have the ability to say, if people who vote are not going to sit on this public group that will affect national policy, and that is a condition, and that's the end of it.
Well, again,
the
important thing to keep in mind, the proper analogy here is that political affiliation, we know that can be taken into account. Now, in this particular context, the Trade Act expressly prohibits that. But in the First Amendment cases, the Pickering, the Elrod line of cases make clear that when you're a policymaker, you can take into account the government can decide to fire you even after you've already gotten your position for your policy-related speech, and you can choose for political position. That's obviously protective activity.
Yeah, but what
that's
we do is we put those, as Judge Tatel has been suggesting, we put those in context and we balance the purported government interest against what is being asserted by the individual who's agreed.
But not certainly not in the same way when you're talking about political affiliation. That's the lesson of cases like Hall versus Ford, Foote v. Town of Bedford, and Elrod. That line of cases say, no, where you're in the context of a classic Pickering case where you're retaliating on the basis of speech, taking action against a high-ranking advisor who's a policy...
Because of inconsistent policies.
Right, but would otherwise be protected.
The person that's head of the department, group, agency, is entitled to have consistency in policy.
Right,
that's not surprising in important cases.
Right, and here the president...
That's a Pickering kind of analysis.
Right, and here the president has simply said that in this context, I don't want to hear from paid lobbyists who we already regularly hear from. And there's nothing in the First Amendment that forecloses the president from saying that. And nowhere has there been any unconstitutional condition case that comes close to applying in a way to restrict the government's ability to choose its advisors in the manner that the plaintiffs are seeking.
Because no one has ever supposed, no president has ever supposed that there are no such limitations and therefore has tested it.
Well,
there are no such cases. No one has ever tried to do anything of the sort that's being claimed here.
I mean, I really think that's not right.
Well,
I mean, the president hears from
case?
A lot of different
where's
people.
Here's a case that positively says you're absolutely right in your very firm assertions about the president can impose any limitation the president wants to.
I mean, again, when we're talking about these formal advisory committees, you have the Federal Advisory Committee Act, important, requiring fair balance. You know, we're prohibiting these from being dominated by special interests, properly influenced by a special interest. But it's a different matter to say, no one thought prior to FACA that the use of the kind of imbalanced committees that led to FACA's enactment were unconstitutional.
Let me get the question a different way, because I'm just as troubled by Judge Edwards about this. Your argument about the president's ability to pick his advisors is fine. That makes sense. But suppose we disagreed with you about Perry or Pickering and thought one of them applied because this was a limitation on a First Amendment right. Let's just assume for purposes of my question that it is, okay? Then, whether you're looking at Perry or Pickering, how do you then justify the restriction on lobbyists? Assuming that there is a First Amendment right here.
These are policy. Then under Pickering would properly apply in those circumstances.
And what would be the justification? And counsel for plaintiff just stood up and said, it's obvious that there's no justification for this. That these committees are by definition special interests. So what's the reason for excluding lobbyists?
Because the president can properly say that you're not the only people who could fit the bill and provide the advice that
everybody on these committees. Take a look. I looked at one of these. Aerospace equipment, ITAC number one. Here's who's represented. Representatives are people from employees, by the way, of Boeing, Pratt & Whitney, Gulfstream, General Electric, Lockheed Martin, Honeywell. I mean, these are special interests on these committees. That's who they are, and these are people who are paid by those interests. So what's the justification for separating out lobbyists?
The justification is that it's perfectly appropriate for the president.
Don't tell me the answer to my question is that I'm wrong. I'm just asking you you're not going to win your case that way.
No,
may be a very strong and compelling reason for separating out paid lobbyists. I'm just asking you to tell us what it is.
Maybe you're right.
But you can't win by telling me it's obvious.
No, among other things, as the president indicated, to hear fresh voices.
Lockheed Martin?
No,
Gulfstream? What are you talking about?
Because these people are asked to resign to be able to join, and they're all the same voices.
Right.
It's just whether you're wearing a certain coat
yesterday
or today, they're all the same voices.
That's not necessarily true, Your
it's
Honor.
It's very much so, because all these people have resigned from quote-unquote lobbying, now they're in play. They're all the same voices, and when they finish the little bit they're doing, they'll go right back to in the official category.
And
it's all the same people.
I disagree with that,
based on what? You're just asserting. You're not hearing yourself. You're just stating conclusively based on nothing that we see in the record. There is no record. That's what Judge Tatel started out with initially. What's in the record to support your claim?
Right, and in a case like this, where the question is, even if you are in a Pickering approach, what we're saying is that this, in cases where policymaking advisors are, even when they're being terminated in retaliation for their speech, no great record needs to be developed. As the town of Bedford case from the First Circuit from 2011 is instructive, the court made clear that you can be properly terminated for your speech,
with the policy of the governing body. There's a reason there, so.
Right.
You have to show the inconsistency. The record in that case.
Right.
That's not a little matter, that's big.
No, and here, with respect to here, the purpose of these committees are to allow us to hear from who we want to hear from.
But the purpose of the committees, as I understand it, is to represent the interest, right, in whatever sector, economic sector, they come from. So what's your response to counsel's argument that it's irrational to ban the people who, one, the industry wants to represent them, and two, who have the expertise to do it?
Because it's permissible for the president to say, we hear from registered lobbyists for a whole wide variety of other settings, and in this setting, other people that we haven't heard from before and don't regularly hear from, we can properly decide to in this particular context be the ones to give us advice and information. And there's nothing in the First Amendment. They may quarrel, they may feel like they're more qualified, but it's the president's prerogative to say, no, this is who we want to hear from.
Thank you. Does Mr. Rothfeld, did he have any more time? You can take 2 minutes, if you'd like.
Great, thank you very much, Your Honor. I'll be quick and just make two very quick points. First, on the question of the Pickering balance, if that's going to be engaged in, the government plainly has, as the courts have articulated, a very heavy burden in this context where there's a blanket restriction on First Amendment activity to demonstrate that the restriction they impose is narrowly tailored and that it is, in fact, effective in accomplishing its purposes. The only rationale that I heard Mr. Robb explain this morning for excluding lobbyists from the ITAX is that the government wants to hear from different voices. That rationale is simply disconnected from the rationale of the ITAC, the purpose of the ITAC. The purpose of the ITAC is to allow private sector entities to present their views effectively.
So if we were to agree with you that this is either a Perry or a Pickering case, what role does Knight's, the Supreme Court's view in Knight that the government, president, does have discretion to pick its own advisors, does that play any role at all in your mind, or does that come up in the balancing? Where do we take account of that?
I think for the reasons that were suggested in the questioning, that Knight simply has no bearing here. The issue in Knight was whether individuals had a constitutional right to have their views presented to and considered by government decision makers. The Supreme Court said no. That's not what we're contending here. We don't say anyone has a right to be on an ITAC or to have their views considered by the government. We are saying there is a government program, a regularized program put in place to obtain advice in certain circumstances. There are established selection criteria, just as in the government employment context. And the ITACs are not different in any material respect from hiring somebody into the Department of Justice or the Department of Commerce.
Well, if that's the case, then it looks a lot like a Pickering case.
Right? And again, I think we are happy to have the court go through a Pickering analysis.
But then maybe in the balancing, we would give some weight to, on the government side, to what the Supreme Court has said is a powerful interest in the executive branch to pick its own advisors.
Well, this is not a case, obviously, in which we're talking about the presidential staff or the president picking people for the cabinet. This is...
I understand that.
You know, it's one more. People in the ITACs are sort of basically no different than people in the policy offices in the Department of Justice, Department of Commerce. I don't think anybody would suggest that hiring into the Office of Legal Policy or the policy staff of the FTC is not affected by constitutional restrictions.
Why isn't it a legitimate interest for them, for the government to say, look, we want to hear directly from the companies. So what we want on these things are representatives of Lockheed and Boeing who work there. We don't want the Washington lobbyists on these particular committees. Is that...
The question would be, in a Pickering context, is that, in fact, a rationale that makes sense, that is effective, that can be matched up against the purposes of the committees?
The legitimate point the government's raising is there is a notion that the president can select his advisors. That's well understood. And could the government not say, look, you know, the president's just uneasy with folks who are currently lobbyists. We can't objectify it more than that. There is a public perception about lobbyists. People are going to be less trusting of results coming from committees that are flooded with lobbyists. And so the president can't work as effectively if that's such a situation. Why isn't that permissible?
Well, I would say that in selecting his White House staff, his direct personal advisors, the president doubtless has a very high level of discretion going into that. But what we're talking
about... You want to distinguish between those who are very close to the president as opposed to important advisory committees.
I would distinguish...
It's not an unimportant advisory committee. There are advisory committees that are just back name. As I understand it, these committees have a little more weight.
But these committees, again, I think in their operation are similar in their purposes to a policy staff in the Department of Commerce and Department of Justice. And the president could not say, I'm uneasy with having Catholics on my providing advice that are going to work up through the system to the Attorney General and get to me, or I'm uncomfortable having people who have exercised their right to vote on the policy staff in the Department of Commerce. And so they are categorically excluded as government employees. ITACs are no different from that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ron.